Flap-Lips de Jager asked. It was apparent nobody knew the answer, until Dani Kutsia said, "He's probably the new headmaster." There had been some talk among the kids the previous term about the headmaster and his drinking problem. I had wondered at the time what a drinking problem was. Obviously it was something pretty bad, or the huge morose man we all feared wouldn't be leaving. One of the kids started to chant softly. "Puss cop's in trouble, puss cop's in trouble." The others quickly took up the chant, which grew louder and louder. I placed my hands over my ears to try to stop it.
"Still!"
The dormitory rang to the command. M'fro stood at the doorway, her huge body filling the doorframe.
"We was just talking, M'fro,"
Dani Kutsia said. As the oldest of the small kids, he assumed the position of spokesman.
"You know that talking after lights out is verboten, Kutsia."
Dani Kutsia was left standing at the end of my bed as the others tiptoed back to their beds.
"Ja, M'fro. Sorry, M'fro."
His voice sounded small and afraid.
"Bend over the bed, man,"
M'fro instructed. The cane cut through the air in a blur as she planted it into the seat of Kutsia's pajamas. He let out a fearful yelp, and holding his bum with both hands, hopped up and down. Without further ado, M'fro left the dormitory. For a moment there wasn't a sound, and then Dani Kutsia, his voice on the edge of tears, blurted out,
"You will pay for this, you bloody puscop, Brunick!"
I waited until everyone was asleep and then crept quietly to the window. The full moon brought a soft sheen to the leaves of the grapefruit trees, which seemed to shimmer in the ghosted light. Grandpa Chook's headless snake made a silver loop in the moonlight, a beautiful and unexpected decoration on the branch of the cashew tree.
"I didn't cry. They'll never make me cry again," I said to the moon. Then I returned to my bed. It was the loneliest moment that had ever been.
Grandpa Chook's cover was blown the following morning. Like all Kaffir chickens, he was an early riser. Before even the 6 o'clock wake-up bell went, the whole dormitory had awakened to his raucous crowing. I awoke startled out of a deep sleep to see him perched on the windowsill nearest my bed, his long, scrawny neck stretched in a mighty rendition of cock-a-doodle-doo. Then he cocked his head to one side, gave a tiny squawk, and from the window flew onto my iron bedhead. Stretching his long neck towards me, almost to the point of losing his balance, he gave my ear a gentle peck. The kids raced from their beds to surround me.
"It's an old Kaffir chicken, come to visit Puscop,"
Flap-Lips de Jager yelled excitedly. Grandpa Chook, imperious on the bedhead, fixed them with a beady stare.
"He's mine," I said defiantly. "He's my friend."
Well, you should have heard them carry on. Dani Kutsia, temporarily forgetting his revenge for the caning the previous night, chortled.
"Don't be stupid, man. Nobody has a Kaffir chicken for a friend."
"I do. He can do tricks and everything."
"No, he can't. He's a dumb Kaffir chicken. Wait till the judge hears about Puscop's new friend,"
Flap-Lips de Jager volunteered, and everyone laughed. The wake-up bell went, which meant M'fro would arrive in a minute or two, so we all scrambled back into bed to await her permission to get up. I barely had time to push Grandpa Chook through the window into the orchard and climb back into bed when her huge form loomed through the door. M'fro paced the length of the dormitory, her shambok hanging from a loop on the black leather belt of her dark blue uniform. She stopped as she reached my bed, whipped off the blanket and examined the dry mattress.
"Hmph,"
she snorted, dropping the blanket onto the floor. I jumped from my bed and stood beside it. She ignored me and turned slowly to address the dormitory.
"I am warning you, Kinders. If I hear you talking after lights out again, my shambok will also talk to all of you, you hear?"
"Ja, M'fro," we chorused.
Suddenly her eyes grew large and seemed almost to pop out of her head.
"Puscop, there is chicken shit on your pillow."
I looked down at my pillow in horror. Deposited neatly between two lines of its mattress-ticking cover, Grandpa Chook had left his green and white calling card.
"Explain, man!" M'fro roared.
No explanation, but the truth was possible. Shaking with terror, I told her about Grandpa Chook. Mevrouw glowered at me, and undoing the buckle of her leather belt, she slipped a cane from it.
Paskop, I think you are sick in the head like your poor mother. First you come here and you piss in your bed every night, then you come back and you fill it with chicken shit.
She pointed to the end of the bed where Dani Kutsia had taken his medicine the previous night.
Bend over, she commanded.
She blasted me 4 strokes of the shambok. Biting back the tears, I forced myself not to grab my bum by clamping my hands tightly between my thighs and hunching my shoulders. This also seemed to stop me shaking. What a shit of a day already.
Clean up your pillow and bring this devil's chicken to the kitchen door after breakfast, you hear?
At the door she turned and faced us.
Go to the showers now, she commanded.
Grandpa Chuck and I were in a terrible jam, all right. After breakfast, I slipped out of the hostel to find him. He was still in the old orchard, clucking and scratching around looking for worms. I produced a slice of bread which I'd saved at breakfast, and while breaking it up into bits small enough for him to swallow, explained the latest disaster to him. So much for my resolution not to cry, I could feel the tears running down my cheeks. After Grandpa Chuck had had his breakfast, I picked him up, and fighting my way through the cocky weed and blackjack, I took him to the edge of the orchard to a low corrugated iron fence which marked the hostel boundary. Standing on tiptoe, I looked over the fence. My heart gave a leap. In the distance, I could see 3 Kaffir huts with smoke rising from a fire. For sure, they'd keep Kaffir chickens, and Grandpa Chuck could board with them. Considerably cheered, I explained this new plan to Grandpa Chuck and then pushed him over the fence. There is a blurred distinction between imagination and reality in a 5-year-old child, and the new plan, once imagined, was immediately achieved. Grandpa Chuck, though, had other ideas. With an indignant squawk and a flap of his wings, he was back on my side of the fence. We pantomimed for the next few minutes. Over the fence I'd put him, and back he'd come. Finally, it became clear that the toughest damn chicken in the whole wide world had no intention of deserting his friend, even if his own life was at stake. We waited at the kitchen door for about 10 minutes before Mevrouw appeared.
So this is the chicken that shits in your bed, Puskop?
It wasn't on purpose, Mevrouw. He's very clean and very clever, too.
Look who talks of clean. A chicken is a chicken. Who ever heard of a clever chicken?
Look, Mevrouw, I'll show you.
I quickly drew a circle in the dust, and Grandpa Chuck immediately hopped into it and settled down as though he were laying an egg, which he couldn't, of course.
He'll stay in that circle until I say to come out, I said.
For a moment, Mevrouw looked impressed, and then she suddenly scowled.
This is just some dumb thing Kaffir chickens do that white chickens don't, she said smugly.
No, Mevrouw, I begged. He can do lots of other things, too.
I made Grandpa Chuck hop around the perimeter of the circle on one leg, going squawk with every hop. I showed her how he would fly onto my shoulder and at my command peck my ear. This last trick signaled the end of Mevrouw's patience.
"Your hair will be full of lice, you stupid boy!" she screamed.
Just inside the kitchen door stood a butcher's block with a large cleaver resting on it.
"Give me that filthy, lice-ridden, bed-shitting Kaffir chicken!"
she yelled, grabbing the cleaver. 2 cockroaches resting under the cleaver on the block raced up the back of Mevrouw's hand. She let out an almighty scream, dropping the cleaver and frantically flapping both arms. 1 cockroach dropped to the floor, while the other ran up her arm and disappeared down her bodice. With a delighted squawk, Grandpa Chuck came charging into the kitchen and scooped up the cockroach frantically crossing the kitchen floor. Mevrouw was waving her arms, her bosoms jiggling up and down. She made little gasping noises, as though she was struggling to get a scream out as she danced from one foot to the other in extreme agitation. The 2nd cockroach fell from under her skirt and made for a crack in the polished cement floor, but Grandpa Chuck was too fast for it and had it in a trice. Mevrouw had turned a deep crimson, and her head seemed to vibrate from the shock.
"It's all right, Mevrouw. The other one fell out and Grandpa Chuck got it," I said,
pointing to Grandpa Chuck strutting around, looking very pleased with himself. I rushed to fetch a kitchen chair, and Mevrouw plopped down into it like an overripe watermelon. Taking a dishcloth from a drying rack beside the huge black wood-burning stove, I began to fan her the way I had seen Nanny do when my mother had one of her turns. I became aware of a dripping sound coming from under the rattan seat of the chair and realized in alarm that Mevrouw had pissed her pants. I think she must have been too upset to notice it herself. I wondered how many strokes pissing your pants would earn in her book. When she had recovered somewhat, she pointed a trembling finger at Grandpa Chuck.
You're right, Piscop. That is a good chicken. He can stay. But he has to earn his keep, she gasped.
Then she seemed to become aware of what had happened beneath the chair.
Go now, she said,
and grabbing the cloth from my hand, she pointed to the door. And that's how Grandpa Chuck came to do kitchen duty. Every day after breakfast, he checked every last corner in the hostel kitchen for creepy crawlies of every description. The toughest damn chicken in the world had survived. He had beaten the executioner by adapting perfectly, and we were safely together again. The weeks and then a couple of months went by. I had become slave to the judge. In return for being at his constant beck and call, I was more or less left to my own devices. The odd cuff behind the head or a rude push from an older kid was about all I had to endure. Things were pretty good, really. If the judge needed me, he would simply put two fingers to his mouth and give one of his piercing whistles, and Grandpa Chuck and I would come running. Grandpa Chuck was now under the protection of Mevrouw, although he still needed to be constantly on the alert. Farm kids just can't help chucking stones at Kaffir chickens. He would cluck around the playground during lessons, hunting for grubs. The moment the recess bell went, he would come charging over to my classroom, skidding to a halt in the dust, cackling his anxiety to be with me again. No class existed for my age, and so I had been placed with the 7-year-old kids, all of whom were still learning to read. I had been reading in English for at least a year, so that the switch to reading Afrikaans wasn't difficult, and I was soon the best in the class. Yet I quickly realized that survival means never being best at anything except being best at nothing, and I soon learned to minimize my reading skills, appearing to pause and stumble over words which were perfectly clear to me. Mediocrity is the best camouflage known to man. Our teacher, Miss Duplessis, wasn't anxious for a 5-year-old Rennick to shine in a class of knot-headed boors. She was happy enough to put my poor results down to my inability to grasp the subtlety of the Afrikaans language, as well as being the youngest in class, whereas I already spoke Zulu and Shangaan, and like most small kids, found learning a new language simple enough. It became increasingly hard for the other kids to think of me as being different when no visible or audible differences separated us. Except, of course, for my hatless snake. But even this, like a kid with a birthmark or a little finger missing, started to go unnoticed. I was becoming the perfect stick insect. And then, on September the 3rd, 1939, Neville Chamberlain finally and sadly concluded that Herr Hitler was not a gentleman, not to be trusted, and not open to negotiation. That Britain, having let Czechoslovakia down thoroughly, couldn't face the embarrassment of doing the same thing to Poland, and so found it necessary to declare war on Germany. The new headmaster had arrived. At lunch in the hostel dining hall, the old headmaster with the drinking problem addressed us. He stood, swaying slightly, both hands holding the edge of the table. Then, picking up a knife, he thumped it on the table with the handle.
"Silence!" he roared.
Whereupon Miss Duplessis, lips pursed, rose quickly and left through the swinging doors. The old headmaster seemed not to notice. Dropping the knife onto the table, he started to talk in a very loud voice, as though he were addressing hundreds of people.
"Today, England has declared war on Germany."
He paused to gauge the effect of his words on us. There was no reaction except for a low murmur from where the senior boys sat.
"Do you know what this means, man?"
Not waiting for an answer, he continued.
"It means freedom. Freedom and liberty for our beloved fatherland. Adolf Hitler will destroy the cursed English and remove the yoke of oppression placed on the Afrikaner nation by these Uitlanders who burned down homes and imprisoned Boer women and children in concentration camps, where 26,000 died of starvation, dysentery and black water fever."
The headmaster made it sound as though it was all happening at this very moment in South Africa. I suddenly realized that this was what had really happened to my mother. She had been mistaken for a Boer woman and put in a concentration camp. The headmaster took a couple of steps back from the table, and then lurched forward again, his spit-flecked mouth working silently, as though he were trying to say something, but it wouldn't come out. Instead, he raised his arm in the same way the judge had done in the dormitory.
"Heil Hitler!"
he blurted out at last. Just then the doors burst open, and Mefrou entered the dining room. Through the briefly open doors we could see Miss Duplessis standing in the hallway, biting her knuckles. Mefrou marched up to the headmaster, and taking him firmly by the elbow, she led him quickly from the dining hall.
"Heil Hitler!"
he shouted back at us as he passed through the swing doors. We sat there, bewildered. Then the judge jumped to his feet, and stepped up onto the bench on his side of the top table. He rolled the sleeve of his shirt up over the top of his shoulder, so we could all see the crude blue, crossed and angled lines of his swastika tattoo.
"Adolf Hitler is the king of Germany, and God has sent him to take South Africa back from the English and give it to us."
He jabbed at the swastika on his arm.
"This is his sign, the swastika. The swastika will make us free again."
His right hand shot up in the same salute the headmaster had given moments before.
"Heil Hitler!" he cried.
We all jumped to our feet, and thrusting our arms out in the manner of his own, yelled,
"Heil Hitler!"
It was all very exciting. To think that this man, Adolf Hitler, who was going to save us all from the accursed English, was going to be our new headmaster. Then slowly at first, the words of the judge on the first night back at school began to form in my mind, gathered momentum, and then roared into my consciousness.
"Don't be stupid, Piscop, you are the fucking English!"
The long march to the sea had begun. Flaplips de Jager at our table just kept on shouting, "Heil Hitler!" And soon everyone was chanting it louder and louder. A piercing whistle from the judge finally stopped them.
"Some of us have sworn a blood oath to Adolf Hitler, and the time has now come to march the Reunachs into the sea. After school we will meet behind the shithouses for a council of war."
I don't suppose any of us had much idea of where the sea was supposed to be, somewhere across the Lebombo Mountains and probably over the Limpopo River. Whichever direction, it was a long, long way away. The long march to the sea would be a pretty serious undertaking, and I could understand why it would take some planning. The dining room buzzed with excitement, and the judge held up his hand to silence us. Then he pointed directly at me.
"Piscop, you are our first prisoner of war."
He brought his fingers together and raised his arm higher.
"Heil Hitler!" he shouted.
We all jumped up again, but the two kids on either side of me pushed me back into my seat.
"Heil Hitler!"
the rest of the dining hall chorused back. It was the most exciting day in the school's history, although my own prospects looked pretty bleak. What was certain was that Grandpa Chuck and I were living on borrowed time, and needed to make some pretty urgent escape plans. I was in despair. Even if I did know how to get home, which I didn't, how far could a little kid and a chicken travel without being spotted by the enemy? That afternoon in class, Miss Duplessis, who seemed even more upset than usual, rapped my knuckles sharply on two occasions with her 18-inch ruler. In the end, she grew totally exasperated when, deep into my escape plans, I simply didn't hear her ask what 3 times 4 came to.
"Domkop! You'll have to stay in after school."
The idea was impossible. Grandpa Chuck and I had to escape before the Council of War met behind the shithouses.
"Please, miss. I'm sorry, miss. It won't happen again, miss," I begged.
In a desperate attempt to make amends, I blew my camouflage. I recited the 9 times table, then the 10, 11, and 12. I had carefully concealed my knowledge of anything beyond the 4 times table, and what's more, we hadn't even reached the 11 and 12 times table in class. The effect was profound. By the time I had almost completed the 12 times table, which I'd learnt from the back of the judge's arithmetic book, Miss Duplessis was consumed by anger.
12 times 12 is, 144,
I announced, my voice faltering as I perceived the extent of her indignation.
"You wicked, rotten, lying, cheating child!"
she screamed, raising her steel-edged ruler. The blows rained down on me, though in her agitation her aim was wild, and I took most of them on my arms and shoulders. One swipe got through my guard, and the thin metal strip in the ruler sliced into the top of my ear. I dropped my guard and grabbed at my ear, which was stinging like bilio. The warm blood started to run through my fingers and down my arm. The sight of the blood snapped Miss Duplessis out of her frenzy. She looked down at me and brought her hand to her mouth. Then she screamed and fell dead at my feet. The shock of seeing Miss Duplessis drop dead at my feet was so great I was unable to move. The blood dripped from my ear onto her spotless white blouse, until a crimson blot the size of my fist stained the area just above her heart.
"Cripes! You've broken her heart and killed her,"
I heard Flaplips de Jager say as he ran from the classroom. All the others followed, screaming as they fought each other to vacate the scene of the crime. I just stood there, unable to think, the blood leaking from my head. I was unaware of anyone entering the room until a huge hand lifted me and hurled me across the classroom, where I landed against the wall. I was too stunned to hurt and sat there, propped up by the wall like a discarded rag doll. Mr. Stoffel, the master who taught the judges' class, was on his knees, bending over Miss Duplessis and shaking her by the shoulder. His eyes grew wide as he observed the blood on her blouse.
"Shit, he's killed her," I heard him say.
Just then Miss Duplessis opened her eyes and sat up like Lazarus. Then she looked down and saw her blood-stained blouse, and with a soft sigh she passed out again. Mr. Stoffel slapped her cheeks, and she opened her eyes and sat up.
Oh, what have I done?"
she sobbed. Quite suddenly the classroom grew very still and dark, like a cloud passing over the sun. I could dimly see Mr. Stoffel coming towards me, his long, hairy arms flapping at his sides as though in slow motion, his shape wavy at the edges. I tried to cover my face, but my arms refused to lift from my lap.
"Look what happens when you forget your camouflage, Puskop," I observed to myself.
Then I must have passed out. I awoke in my bed in the small kid's dormitory, but before I'd opened my eyes, I could smell M'Fro at my side. She must have seen the flicker of my eyelids.
"Are you awake, Puskop?"
she asked, not unkindly.
"Ja, M'Fro."
I was back in the real world, and I quickly gathered my mental camouflage about me. My head was swathed in a thick crepe bandage, and I was wearing my pajamas. My head didn't hurt a bit, but my shoulder ached where I'd landed against the wall.
"Now listen to me, Puskop."
There was a note of urgency in M'Fro's voice.
"When the doctor comes, you must tell him you fell out of a tree, you hear?"
"Ja, M'Fro."
"What tree did you fall out of, Puskop?"
she asked.
"There was no tree, M'Fro."
I had fallen at once for the trick.
"Domkop!" she shouted. "Wash out your ears! What did I just tell you, man?"
"It was the mango tree, the big one next to the playground," I corrected.
"Ja, that's good. The mango tree."
She rose from the chair beside my bed.
"You have a good memory when you try, Puskop. Remember to tell the doctor when he comes."
No sooner had she left than I leapt from the bed and ran to the window where I whistled for Grandpa Chuck. In a few moments he appeared, clucking and beady-eyed as ever, as he came to rest on the windowsill beside me.
"Grandpa Chuck, we're in a lot of trouble," I told him,
and explained about the arrival any day now of Adolf Hitler, who was coming to march us into the sea.
"Can you swim?"
I asked him. Grandpa Chuck was so amazing that it wouldn't have surprised me if he turned out to be the only chicken in the world who could swim.
"Squawk,"
he replied, which could have meant he could or he couldn't, who's to say? Grandpa Chuck wasn't always easy to understand. We could hear voices coming towards the dormitory, so I quickly pushed Grandpa Chuck back into the orchard and jumped into my bed. To my joy, M'Fro entered with Dr. Henny. He sat on my bed and unwound the bandage around my head.
"What's the matter, son? You look pretty done in."
Even if Dr. Henny wasn't a Roenick, I knew he was on my side, and I longed to burst into tears and tell him all my troubles. But I had already blown my camouflage once that day with near disastrous results. A bandaged ear and a sore shoulder weren't too bad a result for having been unforgivably stupid. Next time I might not be so lucky. Choking back the tears, I told him how I had fallen from the big old mango tree next to the playground. I must have laid it on a bit thick because he turned to Mefro, and in Afrikaans he said, "Hm. Except for the cut between the ear and the skull, there are no contusions or abrasions. Are you quite sure this child fell from a tree?" "The other children saw it happen, Doctor. There is no doubt." Mefro said this with such conviction that I began to wonder myself. I realized that Dr. Henny's line of questioning could only mean trouble for me.
"It's true, sir. That's what happened. I fell out of the tree and hurt my shoulder against the wall."
Dr. Henny didn't seem to notice that I'd replied in Afrikaans. "The wall? What wall?" Fear showed for a moment in Mefro's eyes, but she quickly recovered.
"The child doesn't speak Afrikaans very well. He means the ground."
"Yeah, the ground,"
I added, my camouflage damn near blown sky high. Dr. Henny looked puzzled.
"Okay, let's look at your shoulder then."
He rotated my shoulder clockwise.
"That hurt? Tell me when it hurts."
I shook my head. He moved it the opposite way with the same result. Then he lifted it upwards and I winced.
"That's sore, eh?"
I nodded.
"Well, it's not dislocated anyway."
He checked my heart and chest and my back with his stethoscope, which was cold against my skin.
"Seems fine. We'll just put in a couple of little stitches and you'll be right as rain," he said in English.
"Can I go home, please?"
"No need for that, old son. You'll be brand new tomorrow."
He dug into his bag and produced a yellow sucker.
"Here. This will make you feel better. You get stuck into that while I fix up these stitches."
He must have seen the look on my face.
"Yeah, it's going to hurt a bit, but you're not going to cry on me now, are you?" "He's a brave boy, Doctor," Mefro said,
relaxed now that the truth had remained concealed.
"Well done," Henny said, dabbing my stitches with mercurochrome. "No need for a bandage. We'll be back in a week to remove the stitches."
He turned to Mefro.
"Let me know if he complains of backache."
He took a second sucker from his bag and handed it to me.
"That's for being extra brave."
"Thank you, sir. Dr. Henny, are you English?"
I asked, taking the second sucker. His expression changed, and I could see that he was upset.
"We are all South Africans, son. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise."
He spoke with a quiet vehemence, then repeated,
"Don't let anyone ever tell you anything else."
I had certainly had better days, but a two-sucker day doesn't come along very often, so it wasn't all bad. Despite my prisoner of war status, the kids were pretty good for the next few days. My stitches made me a hero in the small kids' dormitory, and even Marty the Jager kept his loose mouth buttoned for a change. We had a new teacher, Mrs. Gerber, who turned out to be the wife of the government vet who had once come out to the farm to check Grandpa's black Orpingtons for Newcastle's disease. Mrs. Gerber wasn't tetchy, and I don't think she even knew I was a Roynik. She wasn't a real teacher, so she was quite nice. There was a rumor going around that Miss Duplessis had suffered a nervous breakdown. I knew, of course, that I was to blame, and it struck me with dismay that I had probably been the direct cause of my mother's nervous breakdown as well. I must be a nervous breakdown type of person. First my mother, now Miss Duplessis, and while I hadn't given Mefro one yet, I had caused her to piss in her pants, which was probably the next best thing. Grandpa Chuck and I discussed our predicament at some length, but were unable to reach a useful conclusion. After all, Grandpa Chuck was a Kaffir chicken, and they don't have such a good life. One minute you're walking along, scratching about, and the next you're dinner for a jackal or a python, or bubbling away in a three-legged cast-iron cooking pot. Grandpa Chuck, a proven survivor, worked on the principle that if anything bad could happen, it would. A five-year-old isn't much of a pessimist, though we agreed that one thing was for sure, something pretty bad was bound to happen. 3. The night after I had my stitches out, I was summoned to appear before the judge and jury. The judge had been quite nice to me over the past week, and because of my sore shoulder, hadn't required that I carry his books to school each day. In fact, because Mr. Plessis was generally disliked, I'd become a bit of a hero. But Roynecks in this part of the world are not designed to be permanent heroes. I knew it would soon come to an end. When the stitches were out, my temporary reprieve would be over. So here I was again, being marched straight into another calamity.
"Stand to attention, prisoner Peskop,"
the judge snarled. I drew myself up, my arms ramrods at my side.
"Bring his stupid legs together, man,"
one of the jury shouted.
"Name?"
I looked confused. Everyone knew my name.
"What is your name, Peskop?"
the judge asked again.
"Peskop?"
I ventured, still not certain what he meant.
"What does your name mean?"
Again I looked querulous.
"That I piss my bed?"
"Yeah, and chicken shit in it as well. What is a Roynek?"
"I'm English."
"Yes, I know, man, but how do you know you're a Roynek?"
I just know, sir."
The judge shook his head and gave a deep sigh.
"Come here. Come closer, man."
I stepped forward to stand directly in front of where he sat, cross-legged on his bed. The judge's arm came up and my hand flew up to protect my face, but instead of hitting me, he pulled at the cord of my pajama pants, which collapsed around my ankles.
"Your bloody snake has no hat on its head, dumb cop. That's how you know you're English, understand?"
"Yes, sir."
I bent down to pull my pajama pants back up.
"Don't!"
I jumped back to attention.
"What am I, Peskop?"
the judge demanded.
"A boor, sir?"
"Yes, and what is a boor?"
"An Afrikaner, sir."
"Yes, of course, but what else?"
"A boor has a hat on his snake."
Why, when he has made all white people look alike, had God given the English snakes without a hat? It seemed terribly unfair. My camouflage was perfect except for this one little thing.
"Tonight you will learn to march. We must get you ready for your march into the sea."
The judge pointed to the corridor between the beds and gave me a push. I tripped over my pajama pants and fell to the floor. One of the jury reached down and pulled the pants away from my ankles. I rose bare-assed and looked uncertainly at the judge.
"March!"
he commanded, pointing down the corridor between the beds once more. I started to march, swinging my arms high.
"Links, rechts, links, rechts, halt!"
he bawled. Then again,
left, right, halt! Which is your left foot, prisoner Peskop?"
I had no idea, but pointed to a foot.
"Dumb cop, don't you even know your left from your right?"
"No, sir,"
I said, feeling stupid. But I did now. The left side was where my shoulder hurt.
"Every day after school you will march around the playground for 5,000 steps, you hear?"
I nodded.
"You will count backwards from 5,000 until you get to number one."
I couldn't believe my luck. No one had laid a hand on me. I retrieved my pajama pants and scurried back along the dark passage to my dormitory. Being a prisoner of war and learning how to march wasn't such a bad thing. I had nothing to do after school anyway. But I must admit, counting backwards from 5,000 isn't much of a way to pass the time. It's impossible anyway. Your thoughts wander, and before you know it, you're all jumbled up and have to start all over again. I learned to mumble a number if anyone came close, but mostly I did the judge's homework in my head. Carrying his books from school, I would memorize his arithmetic lesson, and then I would work the equations out in my head as I marched along. If things got a bit complicated, I'd make sure nobody was looking, and I'd work out a more complex sum using a stick in the dirt. It got so I couldn't wait to see what he'd done in class each day. The judge was an awful domkop. In the mornings, carrying his books to school, I'd check his homework. It was always a mess, and mostly all wrong. I began to despair for him, and for myself as well. You see, he could only leave the school if the work he did during the year gave him a pass mark. So far, he didn't have a hope. If he failed, I'd have him for another year.
That is, if Hitler hadn't come by then to march me away. Escape seemed impossible, so I'd have to think of something else. Over a period of several marching afternoons, a plan began to form. The something else, when it finally emerged, was breathtakingly simple, though fraught with danger. For the next 2 days, I thought of little else. If I blew my camouflage and helped the judge with his homework so that he would pass, would he not be forced to spare Grandpa Chuck and me if Adolf Hitler arrived before the end of term? I must say I was worried. Every time I had blown my camouflage, disaster had followed. Finally, after a long talk with Grandpa Chuck, we agreed it was a chance worth taking. After breakfast the following morning, when I was folding the judge's blanket and arranging his towel over his bed rail, I broached the subject. He was sitting on a bed, licking his pencil and trying to do some last-minute arithmetic. "Can I help you, sir?" My heart thumped like a donkey engine, though I was surprised how steady my voice sounded. "Push off, Puskop! Can't you see I'm busy, man?" The judge was doing the fractions I'd done in my head the previous afternoon and getting them hopelessly wrong. Gulping down my fear, I said, "What happens if you don't pass at the end of the year?" The judge looked at me. I could see the thought wasn't new to him. He reached out and grabbed me by the shirt front.
"If I don't pass, I'll kill you first and then I'll run away."
I took my courage in both hands.
I can help you, sir," I stammered.
The judge released me and went back to chewing his pencil. His brow furrowed as he squinted at the page of equations. He appeared not to have heard me. I pointed to the equation he'd just completed.
"That's wrong. The answer is 7/9.
I moved my fingers quickly.
4/5, 6/8, 9/10, 5/7.
I paused as he grabbed my hand and looked up at me open-mouthed.
"Where did you learn to do this, man?"
I shrugged.
"It's just easy for me, that's all."
I hoped he couldn't sense how scared I was. A look of cunning came into his eyes. He released my hand and handed me the book and the pencil.
"Just write the answers very softly, and I'll copy them, you hear?"
The camouflage was intact, and I'd moved up into the next evolutionary stage. From knowing to hide my brains, I had now learnt to use them. Grandpa Chuck and I were one step further away from the sea. But I had already experienced the consequences of revealing too much too soon. I knew if a domkop like the judge went from bottom to the top of his class overnight, Mr. Stoffel would soon smell a rat. Telling the judge he was a duffer was more than my life was worth. Besides, I was beginning to understand how manipulation can be an important weapon in the armory of the small and weak.
"We have a problem," I said to the judge.
"What problem, man? I don't see a problem. You just write the answers very soft, that's all."
"Judge, you're a very clever fellow."
"Yeah, that's right, so?"
"So arithmetic doesn't interest you, does it? I mean, if it did, you could do it."
I snapped my fingers.
"Just like that?"
"Yeah, if I wanted to, I could. Only little kids like you are interested in all that shit."
I could see this conclusion pleased him, and I grew bolder.
"So you can't just get 10 out of 10 today when yesterday you only got 2 sums right out of 10. Mr. Stoffel will know there's some monkey business going on."
The judge looked worried.
"You mean you're not going to help me?"
"Oh, of course I am. But you will get better a little bit each week, and you'll tell Mr. Stoffel that you suddenly got the hang of doing sums."
The judge looked relieved, and then grinned slyly.
"Ye us un slimmerky, Puskop," he said.
The judge had called me clever. Me, Puskop, Roynek and possessor of a hatless snake. It was the greatest compliment of my life, and I was beside myself with pride. But before the judge could notice the effect of his words on me, I quickly resumed my obsequious manner. The thrill of the compliment had almost caused me to forget my other anxiety.
"What will happen if Adolf Hitler comes before the end of term?" I asked,
my heart beating overtime. The judge looked at me blankly, then suddenly grinned, understanding the reason for my question.
"Okay, man, you got me there. I will say nothing until I've passed at the end of the year."
He shook his head and gave me a look not entirely without sympathy.
I'm sorry, Pusco. After that, I will have to tell him about you. You must be punished for killing 26,000 poor women and children. You and your stupid Kaffir chicken are dead meat when he comes. But I'll tell you something. I'll give you my word as a Boer. If I pass in sums, I swear on a stack of Bibles not to tell Adolf Hitler until next term.
The judge, his brow furrowed as though he were doing the calculations himself, started to copy over the answers I had written in his exercise book. I had won. My plan had worked. I could hardly believe my ears. Grandpa Chuck and I were safe for the remainder of the term. The judge had come to the end of his copying. I had never seen him quite so happy, not even when he was Heil Hitlering all over the place. I saw my opportunity, and taking a sharp inward breath, said quickly,
"It will be difficult to march every afternoon and still do your homework, sir."
The inside of my head filled with a zinging sound. Had I gone too far? I'd won the battle, and here I was, risking all on a minor skirmish. Marching around wasn't so bad, quite fun, really. What if he realized I used the time to do his homework anyway? The judge sniffed and wiped his nose on the back of his hand.
"All right. No more marching, but you do my homework, you hear? If I catch you and that Kaffir chicken messing around, you'll do twice as much marching as before. You're both prisoners of war, and you better not forget it, man."
Victory was mine a second time. My first conscious efforts at manipulation had been successful. It was a heady feeling as Grandpa Chuck and I followed the judge to school that morning. One thing is certain in life. Just when things are going well, soon after they are certain to go wrong. It's just the way things are meant to be. Mrs. Gerber told us that day in class there had been an outbreak of Newcastle's disease on a chicken farm near Marensky Dam. Her husband, the vet, had left to visit all the surrounding farms. Even the youngest kids know what havoc a disease of any kind can cause with poultry or livestock. Of course, rinderpest and foot-and-mouth disease amongst the cattle were the worst. But every farm keeps at least 50 chickens for eggs, so Mrs. Gerber's news was met with consternation. My mother had once said that if my grandpa lost all his black Orpingtons, it would break his heart. It was pretty depressing to think of my mother with her nervous breakdown in an English concentration camp knitting jumpers with funny sleeves. Knitting away with all the Boer mothers and children as she waited to starve to death or die of blackwater fever. Meanwhile, back on the farm, there was poor old grandpa, slowly dying of a broken heart. That was if Adolf Hitler didn't arrive first. If he did, I knew Grandpa wouldn't even have the strength to make escape plans or drive the Model A, and then what would become of me? Maybe I could live with Nanny in Zululand. This thought cheered me up a lot. Adolf Hitler would never look for a small English person in the middle of Zululand. Nkosi and Nkosikazi would hide me with a magic spell, and they wouldn't have a hope. As for Grandpa Chuck, Adolf Hitler would never be able to tell an English-speaking chicken apart from all the other Kaffir chickens. I decided right there and then, when I got back to the farm, I would put this excellent plan to Nanny. From what we could gather from the judge, who was allowed to listen to the news on Mr. Stoffel's wireless on Saturday nights, the war was going pretty badly for the English. Adolf Hitler had taken Poland, which I took to be a place somewhere in South Africa like Zululand, but where the Po tribe lived. The judge made it sound as though Adolf Hitler could be expected any day now in our neck of the woods. I had no idea that South Africa was on England's side. From where I sat, the English were most definitely the local enemy. While I knew myself to be English, I regarded this as my misfortune, like being born into a poor and degenerate family. Most of my information came from the regular war councils the judge held behind the school shithouses. All the senior hostel boys were stormtroopers, and Dani Kutsier, as head of the small kids' dormitory, was also allowed to attend. As the official prisoners of war, Grandpa Chuck and I were dragged along for the purposes of interrogation and torture. I was blindfolded and tied to the trunk of a jacaranda tree with a rope around my chest and waist, leaving my arms and legs free. This was because two of the main tortures required my hands to be free. Most torture sessions began with the iron bar, which was known as Chinese torture, after the make of the judge's big cheap pocket watch, one of his most treasured possessions.
I was required to hold the bar out in front of me while he timed each session, so that I would have to hold the bar up longer than the previous time before dropping it. My times were duly recorded by a kid called Butti van der Merwe, who was known in the Nazi party as stormtrooper, timekeeper, and tallyman. Van der Merwe was very proud of his job, and would remind me at every opportunity of the minimum time allocated for the next Chinese torture session. If I failed to best my previous time, I got a severe cuff from the judge, and the six stormtroopers whose turn it was to beat me up. The second main torture, which required my hands to be free, was referred to as shooting practice. Every stormtrooper carried a catapult as his deadly weapon. Farm kids all have catapults for shooting birds, and grow very skilled at using them. While they were not allowed to be worn openly, all the senior boys had one stashed away, and they would wear these around their necks at Nazi party meetings. For shooting practice, I was required to stretch my arms out on either side of me with my palms open and turned upwards. An empty jam tin was placed on either hand, and each of the stormtroopers was allowed two shots to try to knock the tins down. The six best results for the day earned the right to beat me up on the next occasion it became necessary. As usual, Butti van der Merwe was the tally man. I must say this for those Nazis. While they hit the tins from 20 feet often enough, only once did I collect a stone which thudded into the butt of my hand. Luckily it was my left hand, as I was unable to use it for several days. Grandpa Chuck would fly up onto a branch of the jacaranda, where he would keep a beady eye on the proceedings. He was known to the Nazi party as Prisoner of War Kaffir Chicken Roenick. There isn't too much interrogation and torture you can do to a chicken. As Mefro's leading kitchen insect exterminator, Grandpa Chuck was pretty safe. Tough as the judge was, he wasn't willing to take Mefro on. He would look up at Grandpa Chuck and say menacingly, "Your time will come, prisoner of war, Kaffir Chicken Roenick. Don't think we've forgotten about you, you hear?" I was constantly fearful for Grandpa Chuck, but there wasn't much I could do about it. Like me, he was a prisoner of war. Together, we just had to hope for the best and try to muddle through. Besides, Grandpa Chuck had it easy up there in the jacaranda tree, while I was the one who suffered at ground level. The Nazi party sessions were held twice a week. Although they would leave me trembling for hours afterwards, the physical damage wasn't too bad. I only got hit if I dropped the iron bar too soon, and in one or two other conditions, like when the judge got very excited or I failed to answer one of his ranting questions fast enough for his liking. "What is your mother, Puskop? A whore, sir?" I had no idea what a whore was, but I knew it was the answer he wanted.
"Who does she sleep with?"
"Kaffir, sir."
"Ach, sus, man! Dirty, stinking Kaffirs!"
the rest of the Nazis would chorus, groaning and sticking their tongues out and clasping their hands to their throats, pretending to vomit. Even the smallest farm kid knows about animal sex, though it never occurred to me that humans performed the same function. I would wonder why this particular answer was so insulting. After all, Nanny had slept with me on her sleeping mat at the foot of my bed all my life, and to the Nazis she was a Kaffir.
"What are you, Puskop? A piece of shit?" I would respond.
"Not shit, dog shit,"
they would all chorus back. You can get used to anything, I discovered. They expected me to make the mistake so that they could all pantomime back. Halfway through the interrogation, I would be blindfolded. Then often in the middle of an interrogation, someone would throw a bucket of water over me. Knowing it might come, but not knowing when, meant that I would get an awful shock. The imagination is always the best torturer. Or they would release half a dozen red ants down my trousers and watch me frantically trying to find them as the ants bit painfully into my scrotum and the soft inner parts of my legs. If I tore my blindfold away, it would mean a double clout from every member of the party. I soon learned that a red ant tends to bite only once if you leave it alone. But let me tell you something, that one bite isn't a very nice experience. If some new trick like the red ants worked, they would congratulate each other loudly and yell with laughter as my legs pumped up and down and my hands searched frantically in my khaki shorts to rid myself of the marauding ants. The judge encouraged new insults and tortures, but he ruled out any torture that left obvious bruises. For instance, Chinese burns were allowed, but pinching was out. As the last term wore on,
Their limited minds ran out of ideas, and as I knew all the answers to all the dumb questions, and had admitted to everything they accused me of while happily accepting all their insults, the proceedings quietened down a lot. I have found in life that everything, no matter how bad, comes to an end. One thing got to all of them more than anything else. They couldn't make me cry. Even the judge, with all the fear he could provoke, could not make me cry. I suspect they even began to admire me a bit. Many of them had little brothers of my age at home, and they knew how easy it is for a 5-year-old to cry. In fact, I had turned 6, but nobody had told me, so in my head I was still 5. Not being able to cry was the hardest part for me as well. Crying can be a good camouflage. In truth, my willpower had very little to do with my resolve never to cry. I had learnt a special trick, and in the process had somehow lost the knack of turning on the tap. What they didn't know was that behind the blindfold I had learnt to be in 2 places at once. I could easily answer their stupid questions, while with another part of my mind I would visit Nkosi Nkosikazi. Down there in the night country, I was safe from the stormtroopers who were unable to harm me or make me cry. As they tied the dirty piece of rag over my eyes, I would take 3 deep breaths. Immediately I would hear Nkosi Nkosikazi's voice, soft as distant thunder.
"You are standing on the rock, above the highest waterfall. A young warrior who has killed his first lion, and is thus worthy to fight in the Impi of Shaka, the greatest warrior king of all."
I stood in the moonlight on the rock above the 3 waterfalls. Far below I could see the 10 stones, wet and glistening, and the white water as it crashed through the narrow gorge beyond. I knew then that the person on the outside was only a shell, a presence to be seen and provoked. Inside was the real me, where my tears joined the tears of all the sad people, to form the 3 waterfalls in the night country. The last term of the year had come to an end. Only 1 more day remained, just 1 more interrogation, then freedom. The judge had pleased Mr. Stoffel with his efforts in the final term, and his poor performance earlier in the year had been forgotten. He was top of his class by the time term ended. Mr. Stoffel would hold him up as an example, and I think he also liked to take a bit of the credit. The judge had been considered a hopeless case, and now he was the star performer. The judge showed me his report card, which said in black and white that he had passed. He had come to accept his brilliance and expected the compliments of his fellow party members. Not only was he tough, but he was also smart. It was a most satisfactory situation. Therefore, I had no reason to expect anything but a light going over at the last interrogation and torture session, before the judge would disappear from my life forever. After all, he owed me something. And as Adolf Hitler, despite his smashing victory at a place called Dunkirk, hadn't arrived yet, he hadn't been compromised one bit. Prisoners of war Piskop and Kafferchicken Roenick were marched off to the jacaranda tree for the last time under the Nazi leadership of the judge. This time I was blindfolded immediately as I was tied to the tree in the usual manner. I could hear Grandpa Chuck squawking away in the branches above me. I was about to visit the night country when the judge's voice rang out harshly.
"This is the last time, English bastard!"
With a sudden certainty, I knew today would be different. That, in his mind, the judge owed me nothing. The bad times were back. I tried to get down to the safety of the night country, but the fear rose in me like a Vesuvius spewing vomit, and I was unable to detach myself from it.
"Today, Englishman, you eat shit."
His use of the word Englishman, rather than the familiar, almost friendly, Roenick, added greatly to his menace.
"Hold your hands out in front of you."
I could hear him sniff as I held my hands out in front of me, palms upwards. He grabbed my arms above the wrists and held them so tightly I couldn't move them.
"Bring it here, stormtrooper van der Merwe," I heard him say.
A soft object was dropped first into one hand and then into the other.
"Close your hands, bastard," the judge commanded.
The pain in my wrists was almost unbearable. Slowly I closed my hands.
"Take his blindfold off," the judge commanded again.
The rest of the Nazis had grown very quiet, and one of them unknotted the blindfold. I blinked at the sudden light. My nose as well as my eyes had been covered by the blindfold, and even before I'd looked down, a terrible smell rose up at me. My hands were sticky, and I opened them to see that they contained two squashed human turds. The judge released my wrists.
"Now lick your fingers," he demanded.
I stood with my hands held out in front of me, not knowing what to do.
"I'm going to count to three. If you haven't licked your fingers, I'm going to knock your bloody head off, you shithouse."
The judge stood pop-eyed in front of me, and I could see he was trembling. I was too deeply shocked to react. I think I would have eaten the shit when the message finally made it through my disconnected brain, but at that moment all the wires were fusing.
"Ian, twee, drie,"
he counted. The judge reached three, and I remained with my hands held out in front of me, quaking with terror. He made a gurgling sort of animal sound deep in his throat. Then, grabbing my wrists, he forced my hands into my mouth. My teeth were clamped shut in fear, and the shit was rubbed all over my lips and teeth and the rest of my face. Some of it must have got onto the judge's hand, because he released my wrists and wiped it through my closely cropped hair. Then he grabbed the tree trunk about 2 feet above my head, his body straddled over mine. First he tried to shake the tree, then he began beating at it with his clenched fists. Suddenly he threw his head back so that he was looking directly upwards into the tree.
"Heil Hitler!" he screamed.
In the tree high above the judge, Grandpa Chuck's anus opened and from it dropped a perfect bomb of green and white chicken shit straight into the judge's open mouth. Grandpa Chuck had waited until the last day of term to give his opinion of the Nazi party. As usual, it was short, accurate, and to the point. The judge spat furiously, bent double, racing around in circles, clutching his throat and stomach, hawking and spitting, and then finally throwing up. He raced for the tap and filled his mouth and spat out about 6 times. Then he stuck his index finger into his mouth like a toothbrush and rubbed his teeth and gums, took more water, and spat and spat.
"Run, Grandpa Chuck! Run, man, run!"
I screamed up into the tree, but Grandpa Chuck had done enough running for one old Kaffir chicken. Sitting squawking up there amongst the purple jacaranda blossom, he sounded as though he was laughing his scraggy old head off.
"Please run, Grandpa Chuck, please, please run! The bastard will kill you!"
I screamed, oblivious to the shit on my face and in my hair. Grandpa Chuck hopped onto a lower branch, and then, to my horror, flew onto my shoulder and gave my ear one of his famous Grandpa Chuck kisses. I grabbed him, intending to throw him on his way, but as I lifted him from my shoulder, there was an explosion of feathers in my face. Grandpa Chuck let out a fearful squawk as he was blasted from my hands and fell to the ground. The judge stood a few feet away, his empty catapult dangling in his left hand.
"Run, Grandpa Chuck! Run for your life!" I pleaded.
Grandpa Chuck tried to get up from where he had landed, but the stone from the judge's powerful catapult had broken his ribcage. He made several more attempts, each time falling back onto his wing. I think he knew it was useless. After a while, he just sat there, looked up at me and said, "Squawk." Dani Kutsia ran over and grabbed Grandpa Chuck. I managed to kick him once, but then he held Grandpa Chuck triumphantly upside down by his legs. Grandpa Chuck beat his wings furiously. The pain must have been terrible. Quite suddenly he stopped, and I thought he must be dead. But then I saw his bright, beady eye, trying to find me from his upside-down position.
"No bloody Kaffir chicken shits on me! Hang him up by the legs next to Puskop!"
the judge commanded. He was still doing little dry spits and wiping his mouth on the back of his hand. Two stormtroopers slung a piece of rope over a branch, and Grandpa Chuck soon hung upside down just beyond my reach, and at about the level of my head.
"Please, sir, I will do anything, anything you ever ask, anything you want. Please don't kill Grandpa Chuck."
The judge, his eyes cruel, bent down and looked into my face.
"Now we'll see who'll cry," he grinned.
I was seized by panic.
"Kill me," I begged. "Please kill me, but don't kill Grandpa Chuck."
The judge butted me on the forehead with the heel of his hand, and my head slammed against the trunk of the jacaranda, leaving me dazed.
"Ugh, shit!"
he exclaimed. Some of the shit on my face had rubbed off onto his hand. Then he wiped his hand into my hair once again.
"You're shit, and your fucking kaffir chicken is shit! Did you see what he did to me? Me, Yapi Bota, that fucking chicken shit!"